Welcome to the United Nations of Horror, a podcast about all things horror. Tonight, I'm joined by the intelligent and beautiful Rebecca Booth. Becky, how are you doing tonight?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. I'm very excited to talk about the film tonight.
Awesome, as am I. I am also joined tonight by the master of horror cinema and the writer of epic books, Mark. How you doing tonight?
Yeah, pretty good, pretty good. Yes, and I'll have another book out soon. Well, it's just short, but it'll be coming soon in the next few weeks or so, I hope, but we'll see, right? We'll see.
Awesome. Definitely keep us up to date on that. I'm sure all our listeners will definitely want to check that out. So our main topic tonight is The Ritual from 2017.
Rob would have loved this place.
He's a good man. The best of us.
You know they have walking trails in England? Pubs.
Come on, man, where's your soul?
It's twisted.
All right, yep.
Easy.
Look, we go southwest through here. We cut the journey in half.
What, through the forest?
Yeah, why not?
I should have gone to Vegas.
Oh, you'd have found something to fall over in Vegas too, mate.
Now, is it me? Or is it really quiet in here?
It's been gutted.
Could be hunters out here.
Bait?
Possibly. Or it's the bit they don't show you in the nature documentary.
It's a warning.
We shouldn't be here.
Where the hell are we, Hutch?
We should pitch the tents.
This is ridiculous, man.
Luke, you're getting soaked.
Did you hear that?
No, I didn't hear anything. Come on.
So are we going to talk about it then or not?
It was a nightmare, Phil.
Well, what happened to you then?
We got spooked and we had bad dreams, all right?
Up last night.
Look at this.
Nothing has done that to you. You've done it to yourself.
Why do you have to deny everything I
say? Because I do not value your judgment.
We need to be working together, man.
Oh my God!
What the fuck is that?
Fucking hell, we don't know where we are!
Before we kind of move into the film, when did you guys first see this?
Well, as you both know, as we've discussed off air quite a bit, I've been waiting forever to see this film, it seems. The novel came out in 2011 that the film was based on. And ever since I heard that it was going to be an adaptation, I've been waiting for it. And I'm sure we'll touch on it, but it had a very limited theatrical run in the UK. And it was meant to be out last year. And it's only just been available now on, different kind of VOD platforms. So I caught it just as it came out here, really.
I only caught it a few weeks ago when it finally came out on DVD, because Becky's talked about this before and I kind of wanted to see it. Now, usually when a film's based on a book, I try and read the book, but I didn't. This one, I just got too much on my plate. I've been reading other books for films coming out, such as Ready Player One and Annihilation. I managed to get through those two, but I didn't get to this one. So I didn't get to the book on this one. So, but I have watched this film recently. I managed to watch it twice for this, I'm glad to say. And I liked it even more the second time, actually. It improves with watching, I think, this one.
It was my first watch of this on Netflix US, and as you mentioned, you know, it got a short theatrical run in England, but in North America, it came straight to Netflix.
You're lucky. We didn't even get it on Netflix.
Yeah, that's
not so fair.
Because it's a British film, and yet it doesn't come on British Netflix.
No, I had to buy it.
What in the world?
The actual theatrical run in the UK must have been absolutely tiny, because in October, I believe, it came out in 2017 to cinemas here, and I could not find it anywhere.
I bet it's only like London and a few rep cinemas. That's it, really.
Yeah.
That's so strange that it was such a small release, because the production of this film is very good. Mm. It doesn't feel like a small independent film to me. It definitely seemed to have some budget behind it. Would you guys agree?
It's certainly got class, and it looks like it's got some budget. There is definitely some money in there, certainly towards the second half. But yeah, there's something there. It was a quality production.
So the script was adapted by Joe Barton from the Humans TV series and directed by David Bruckner, who did The Signal from 2007. He also directed a segment from the VHS film from 2007, and that segment is Amateur Night, and also Southbound from 2015. And interestingly enough, it was produced by Andy Serkis, known best perhaps as Gollum from Lord of the Rings, right?
Star Wars recently, right? Yeah. Snoke as well.
He has a production company now. I think it's called Imaginarium. I went to see him talk about a book that he'd adapted with the production company. And I believe it's using some of the similar technology to, you know, the motion capture stuff that I think was it Weta Studios that kind of pioneered that on Lord of the Rings?
Well, Weta certainly made some great, fantastic advancements in it. Yeah, Weta, yeah.
Well, getting into the plot of the film, reuniting after the tragic death of their friend, four college pals set out to hike through the Scandinavian wilderness. And this can only go well, right, guys? So a wrong turn leads them into the mysterious forest of Norse legend, where an ancient evil exists and stalks them at every turn. So we've seen this premise plenty of times, but I like in this film how these actually feel like real human beings. I mean, I think, and I know, I can't remember which one of our listeners mentions this in some of their feedback, but I mean, it's really refreshing not to have this story with teenagers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing about this is these guys aren't horror film stupid, are they? They're not making bad decisions just to propagate the plot. They're making the best decisions they can given this situation, and it benefits from that. Benefits as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'd agree, and I'd also say that because it's adapted from the novel, that you have a great foundation there with the characters and the film. And I'm sure we'll touch on this again as we kind of explore the plot, but the film does make some changes to the novel in terms of the characters and what motivates them, shall we say. So it was really interesting for me, having read the book first, to see how that played out. But I think that the right choices were definitely made.
Oh, okay. Are we staying spoiler-free initially, or are we going to throw out spoiler warnings now?
I think so. I think as we move through, we'll touch on the plot in chronological order. So I think we can stay spoiler-free for now.
Okay, don't.
Yeah. Well, let's discuss a bit of the characters first before we throw up that spoiler warning. And so starting off, we have Luke, and he's the main protagonist. He's involved in the tragedy that befalls one of the main characters at the beginning of the film, which we'll talk about very soon here. We have Robert, who's played by Paul Reed. And Robert seems to be closest to Luke. So he tries to defuse a situation that we will talk about again at the beginning of the film, and he definitely pays the kind of high price for it. Then we have Hutch, who is played by Robert James Collier, and he seems to be Luke's closest friend after Robert. So he's kind of the understanding guy, but to an extent. Then we have Dom, who I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about Dom, aren't we?
Yeah.
He is not only the butt of his friend's jokes, but he is definitely the guy who complains the most. You know, if he stubbed his toe, he'd probably be complaining about it for a week or so. And
he does whine a bit. I just have to say, this actor, a lot of watchers of this probably won't be aware of this, but this actor is the grandson of Patrick Troughton, who was the second Doctor Who.
Really? Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
And his father, David Troughton, is also a sort of reasonably famous character actor on British TV and comedies as well. So it's kind of quite a lineage, the Troughtons.
And also Luke is played by Rafe Spall, who is Timothy Spall's son.
He's been in so many different things. He's had to sort of point to one that people would know, but he is a British character.
I think.
Oh yeah, probably Harry Potter's. He's the ratty guy in
Wormtail.
Yeah, but he's been in loads of stuff over the years, and he's very entertaining and a great actor.
Last but not least, we have Phil, who is played by Arshar Ali. And unfortunately, there's not much characterization for him, really.
No, he is the weakest characterization in the film, actually. Is that true of the novel as well, Becky?
To an extent, but with the novel, I think, as you know, is typically the case, when you get an adaptation, you've got more time to spend with the characters.
He's the closest thing you get in this film as filler character, really. The others are quite well developed, and he just seems, and he comes off as quite indistinct as a character. You don't quite get a handle on him, do you?
And it's a shame as well, because Arshar Ali, I think, is a great actor. I really liked him in Four Lions.
Yeah, he is a great actor. He wasn't well used in this. A tiny bit of polish on the script could have brought that right up. But these things happen, right? I mean, the other ones were so well done, it kind of stands out.
Yes,
So I think at this point, we should probably throw up a spoiler warning for anyone who doesn't want the plot spoiled. So we start off in a pub, and we have college friends who are organizing their annual lads' holiday. And is this kind of common in the UK for a bunch of guys to get together and just sort of go on a holiday together?
Yeah, actually, it is kind of, I think. Becky, what do you reckon?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's not something I do things like games nights and board game nights with guys and women as well, actually. It isn't unheard of in this country, no, not at all. I'm sure it must be a thing in America too, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have fraternities and things like that. And
I mean, guys go hunting, right, and fishing.
That's a big thing here, and that's something I don't really get. But
we don't do that. We go drinking.
People do that here too. and
people, we can do it 24 hours a day.
Nice. I think you have us beat there. and sometimes people will go hunting and drinking together at the same time. So
that's not a good combination.
What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly.
I think it's a nice opening scene to introduce the characters and their relationships, because straight away you can see that people are a bit annoyed at Dom, for example. And also it's touching on that, not so much middle-aged, but that kind of mentality of, you know, the work slog, they're just living life, going through the motions, they want to get away and kind of relive their youth. But it doesn't overly go into that. So I thought it was a really nice little opening scene.
This isn't an uncommon thing in this country, as I think, probably in other countries. And it was kind of touched on, or it was kind of central, actually, to the Edgar Wright movie, World's End, right?
Yeah.
One of the characters just could not move on and insisted, let's do this, let's go drinking. And, you know, everyone else is like, I've got work in the morning. And there's a nice phrase in this film that made me laugh, which is, we can't do that on a school night. That made me laugh. You know, school night being, you know, during the working week. I use the phrase school night, even though I haven't been to school in years, when it's something during the week, you know, because you've got to get up the next morning and do something.
Exactly.
And I like the way they phrase that. And often when groups of lads do this, when they're young, they want to go to places like, you know, raunchy or lots of fun and, you know, whatever, Ibiza or Amsterdam and stuff like that. But as you get older, I think it's more like, let's do something else, you know. It's a bit more sedate, you know. And that was definitely coming through on this one.
I think a lot of us want to sort of go back and recapture our youth in a way. You know, go partying, go drinking, go to Las Vegas. But you definitely get to a certain age where it's not really smart to do those kinds of things when you have to be up at, you know, 6 in the morning and head to a job the next day.
Yeah, sometimes all you want is a nice cup of tea.
Yes, absolutely. So then we come to the scene with the shop, and this is where things kind of take a sinister turn rather quickly. These guys are choosing alcohol, and I guess they're maybe they are going back to someone's house or even a party or something. So Luke is complaining about Dom, and Robert laughs it off. And, you know, so then you've got these robbers who come in, and they're just holding the place up for money. The cashier is beaten and cowering, and Luke with a vodka bottle in hand hides behind the shelves as this is happening. So Robert, he's trying to defuse the situation, and I thought he was doing a really good job here, but at this point, the robbers ask him to remove his wedding ring after he's already given up his wallet, I believe it is.
And watch.
Oh, yeah, and his watch, too. You're right, yeah. And he refuses. And unfortunately, he pays the ultimate price for that. And these thugs just, you know, they pretty much beat him to death. And he's murdered. So at this point, we've just been introduced to the characters. So how did you both feel about Luke's actions? Mark, let me start with you.
I had a bit of trouble with this because it was only two of those guys. I know they had weapons. And if he just helped his friend, you know, it would have turned out better. And I don't think it's even a case of, well, if I'd have acted in hindsight, I would have done this. I thought he could have acted. There was no reason for him not to act. But the thing is, the whole role here, this whole character is kind of defined from this point on by all of this, as is made fairly clear in the film more than once, right? It was kind of is he planning to do something, you know, because he was like waiting the bottle, like getting the weight of it, like he was going to act, but you never got the feeling he was going to act, right? He was just kind of doing that for himself. But he had no plan to sort of intercept that. It didn't feel like to me. But I don't know, because the violence was so sudden. Who knows, right? But yeah, it was a bit troubling to me.
Do you think it was a case where he was just kind of frozen, just frozen with fear?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, when his friend was obviously going to, you know, it wasn't going well. It seemed like he got it under control a bit, but then it was kind of, now that other guy's come forward, something bad is going to happen now. They're not going to de-escalate themselves. There's two of them winding themselves up. You got to jump in there, but you didn't.
Becky, how about you? How did you feel about Luke's actions?
I think, for starters, the cashier that's seen, that's beaten and cowering, I mean, they've had a good go at her. So they can see the brevity of the situation, and these people, obviously, they're not averse to violence. And I think we've all been in a situation where we've been threatened, and I think he's measuring up when to go, when to strike. And as his friend was seeming to get the upper hand, maybe that was stalling him a little bit. And like you said, the violence was so sudden that it just kind of went out of his hands. But it's a really interesting scene, and it's actually not in the book. Used to, you know, propel the story on screen and to give the characters more, I think, motivation and more tension. Because in the book, Luke's character is basically just pissed off that everybody else is more successful.
Okay. I think it was a good inclusion then, because it all makes sense of what's kind of going on and why certain things happen towards the end to that particular character that wouldn't have been there otherwise. So it kind of, it seems like a good inclusion to me.
I think so. And I also think the elements potentially of post-traumatic stress disorder that we could say that Luke is experiencing throughout the film that are potentially tied into supernatural events. There's different ways I think you could read it. Mm. I think that it really complements that aspect of the story.
It's interesting that here the post-traumatic stress disorders from someone who witnesses something rather than is part of it, right? And it's tied up with his guilt and so on. I mean, you know, we talk about he was frozen, you know, and he was weighing up his things, but the point is, once his friend gets hurt once, he doesn't do anything from that point. And that's the point. If you're going to act, you have to act, right? So there's obviously a deep-seated guilt there, which is very well represented in the dialogue subtly.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Well, these friends do go on their hike. They go camping. But, you know, unfortunately, it is without their friend, and it's a rather mournful event, isn't it? But unfortunately, now it's just more of a remembrance for their friend. I think the most impactful thing here is when they sort of set up a shrine to him, and he pours the alcohol, and, you know, all of them are seemingly having a very rough time here.
I mean, they've gone to this place in Sweden, right? This big national park, and they're kind of making the best of it. It cuts to them like waking up in the morning from a camping. They've camped out, haven't they? And then they set up this little shrine, which I don't know. I guess this happens in America, right? If someone dies tragically, often we see like little bundles of flowers at a certain place. If it's a road accident, you get that too, right? So you could kind of see this, and I've seen this about people that have died suddenly as well. You know, not just road accidents, but other places too. It's quite a sad moment, really, as well.
Yeah,
you go straight from that scene to the holiday. We don't get any of the mourning, or, you know, especially what Luke's been going through. So in terms of the PTSD, it's really the pace of the film is kind of burying what's happened. And I think that you also really get the tension here because nothing has been said about it.
Yeah, I agree. It's a great cut. It is a great decision just to cut to it. It keeps the film very lean.
One of the first shots is of Luke coming out of his tent. And for me, it is very impactful because of that scene and his guilt. It really is a character, you know, as an audience member, it colours that character. And I had a real problem with him because of what had happened. So I think it was a really great narrative device and the way that they use the editing to really back that up.
Yeah, often in films, and maybe in TV, but often in films, when there's a jump cut, there's a cut like that, it's often subliminally suggesting that everything you've watched to this point is set up or pre-story or, you know, and this is now where the story actually starts. So what you've just seen is, you know, the setup, and now we get into the story. And I don't mean just this film. I mean, there's lots of films that kind of use this. It's often used in horror as well. Neil Marshall, I think, has used it in a few films. This film reminded me a lot of The Descent in many ways, actually. An impactful sort of life-changing event and trying to get away from it via some activity. Now, in that, it was like women caving. In this, it's men hiking. But in many ways, it shares a lot of similarities. Did that strike you, Becky?
Yeah. I think it was you that pointed it out in a review on Letterboxd. And as soon as you did, I was like, that's a really great comparison. And I think they make a great double pairing.
Yeah, I feel like this is part of a tradition of some recent British directors' work. You know, Neil Marshall, as I said, and also Ben Wheatley. There's a feeling of Ben Wheatley's Cue List somewhat in this. Not in terms of the story or anything like that, but in terms of the mournfulness of the sort of the slow burn of Descent, you know, of the characters.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think it's quite interesting, as Lucard pointed out at the beginning of the episode, that the director, David Bruckner, I mean, if you think about the three films that were mentioned from 2007 to 2015, he doesn't have a huge backlog. I think he's directed five films, and I think one was a short. Oh, two, I think, if you count the VHS segment. So he's not brand new. I don't want to say that because that's disrespectful, but he doesn't seem to have had a huge career specifically within horror. And I think that this is a really ambitious and stylish, classy production. Same with the script that's been adapted by Joe Barton. The only thing I could see that he was relatively, in terms of experience of horror writing, was the Humans TV series, which isn't really horror. I think he's done some stuff on like World War One documentaries and such. So I thought it was really interesting that you've got this quite new talent, and I don't want to say brand new because they've obviously been working for years, but particularly within horror, I thought that was really interesting.
This guy can write, that's for sure.
And I think as well that the film, as well as taking so much material from the book, though it changes a couple of things, it is quite faithful still. It actually, in terms of filmic influences, pulls in a few scenes from Rituals from 1977.
That's the TV movie, right? Am I thinking of...
Yeah, was that the Peter Carter one? It's set in the Canadian wilderness.
Yeah, I can see that too. It also reminded me a lot of bits of it, certainly reminded me of them, but maybe more the later bits, but I don't know though, some of the early bits too. Ingmar Bergman's Virgin Spring.
Yes.
I felt there was elements of that to the sort of stillness of the forest. This forest looks spectacular, I have to say, in some of
these. Oh, yeah.
Amazing. Absolutely. They obviously did some drone photography and it was just looked terrific and frightening.
I wonder if it was actually shot in Sweden.
It looked like Sweden to me. That definitely looked like. I'm checking now, though. I've said
that. Yeah, I mean, just after seeing this film, I'm like, man, I would like to go hiking through those woods under
better circumstances.
Would you really?
Better circumstances with a tour guide. At this point, Dom hurts his ankle, and this presents a big challenge because they're like, all right, what do? We need to get off this mountaintop and, you know, get to basically the nearest pub. So the group decides to take a shortcut through the forest. And again, if you've seen these films, you know that can only go right.
Yeah. I just want to say one thing. I'm not sure what is that. The thing is, I wasn't quite sure. And the second watch, you know, if it was an ankle or what it was. But on the second watch, he actually says the meniscus is gone, which is a knee. So I think it's his knee.
Oh, is it?
It's a bit unclear from the film, right?
It's in the book. It's his knee.
Okay. He definitely says the meniscus is gone, you know, which is knee. And obviously an old injury he's used to, right?
Yeah.
And there's no way you can walk through that either. They often say, oh, you can't walk through it.
They're trying to just be like, ah, walk it off, you know. I thought his friends were being a little harsh there. What did you guys
think? That's again a British thing. Certainly if you play rugby, any injury is like, ah, you can walk it off. You can run it off. But I'm bleeding from the ears. Nah, you can run it off.
You're still okay.
It's fine.
Well, the first bad sign that these guys come across is an animal carcass that's been splayed up in a tree. And I mean, at that point, I think I would turn back because this just doesn't look natural at all. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, you know, everything in the film looks great. But if I saw that personally, I'd be like, all right, let's head back the other way.
Yeah, there was a bit of gallows humor in all this, wasn't it? It was like, because they start making jokes about bears, and he says, does a bear do that? He goes, I don't know. I'm not an expert on bears.
That was funny.
There's all that sort of stuff. But yeah, that was a bit scary. And it was a bit Blair Witchy at this point, right?
I was going to ask if you guys felt a bit of a Blair vibe to this, because when I first saw the trailer, the first thing that came to my mind was, it's kind of like Blair Witch Project, except, you know, it's a real movie.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of setups, right, that are throwaways that are quite good, which is like, can't we get a signal on the phone? No, what was it? Can't you use your phone? And someone just says, in almost inaudibly, you know, in the background, can't get it. Doesn't matter if even if you had the phone, your phone was charged, you can't get a signal here. And then, as they're going into the forest, he's tapping the compass as if it's not working, right? So there's this setup of disorientation and being lost. Very well done, right? Not mentioned, not explicit, properly filmically done. You know, show us, don't tell us is the way to go with film, and they did it quite well.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, and I would turn around and leave as well.
Yeah, that seems a sensible thing to do, but... despite that, these guys keep moving forward, and they end up moving forward into really bad rain, and it's, you know, it just forces them to seek shelter. So they come up to this dilapidated cabin, and they decide to go inside. Luke seems overtly alert and mentions something outside is watching them. And I don't know, I was feeling this at this point, guys. I have to say, I was like, all right, these woods are creepy, and this cabin is creepy. What do you guys think at this point? Mark, how'd you feel?
Yeah, I was thinking, well, this is not going to turn out well.
Yeah.
And don't they even make jokes about it? At one point, they're saying, yeah, this is the place we're going to get murdered because, like, there's a creepy house here in the creepy woods. And it's kind of, yeah, that sounds right. And when they find that thing upstairs too, it's like, you know, the weird, you know, thing made up to look like a human body without a head or something, like it's praying. It's like,
yeah,
that's enough. So weird. And again, there was like twig-like stuff, so it's kind of, again, Blair Witchy. It's one curious thing that isn't explained at all in the film is at one point, as they're going towards the woods, they come across a camper van just rotting out, and it's like, how the hell did that get there? kind of thing. That made me laugh too.
Especially that close to a mountaintop, right?
It was pretty tense. I thought this was really good, actually, all of this.
Yeah, and I'll just say, having driven around several countries in a camper van, it's very easy to get lost and end up in all sorts of places. But I thought, particularly with Luke being so wary and on edge, I thought maybe he was tapping into something because of his experiences. Was it psychological, potentially? Or, you know, was he sensing something because he was so, on edge and the supernatural aspects? I thought that was really interesting, especially with how things develop. But it's never going to go well, is it? Let's have it right.
So they kind of bed down for a bit, and I think what's his name? Phil says, "I'll give one of you a grand if you go upstairs and sleep with that thing." They make a few jokes, then they like, "Oh yeah, my wife would never forgive me," stuff like that. But none of them are going to go upstairs.
I'm sorry, if you saw that effigy thing, whatever it is up there, you'd be out, wouldn't you? There's no way on earth you'd be staying in that.
Oh, yeah. No way in hell I'm sleeping there.
I might, you know what? I might if I was with some guys, but on my own, probably not. I'd rather just walk on. But if there was with some people, it's like,
oh, I don't know. That's a bad omen, especially after the animal carcass.
Yeah.
The animal carcass was pretty, you know, what caused that?
Exactly. And then there's that strange thing that's obviously man-made, and you're in that house, anybody could come back at any time. I'd be like, gone.
Don't they make jokes about what is good? Doesn't one of them start singing Deliverance, the song from Deliverance, and stuff like that? It's like, it's gonna be Swedish hillbillies or something like that.
They do make quite a few jokes about it, but it's kind of interesting that despite that, I didn't feel like the tension really ever lifted.
No, they were gallows jokes, which works well in this kind of thing, right? Because you've got to make a bit of a joke about this sort of thing. Otherwise, it's like relentless. I mean, if you were in that situation I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
It felt natural, right?
It's true to life. I mean, I tend to make jokes about awkward situations, bad situations all the time. Well, they don't have pleasant dreams either. So Luke sees the shop, which merges with the woods, and I thought this was really cool the way they did this. And he relives his personal horrors, which is Robert getting murdered. He is also aware of something outside of the cabin, and he wakes to find he is outside with a strange symbol kind of carved or punctured on his chest, and he's not going to want to let his buddies see this for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, that looked like quite a nasty injury or whatever it was, didn't it? I'm kind of surprised that it didn't either hurt or bleed out more, or, you know, make itself cause him some sort of more distress than it did. He's kind of freaked out, though, so maybe it's just shallower than it looks, but it looked pretty bad to me. He basically had four holes on one side of his chest, right?
Yeah, it was almost like a wound.
Yeah, or something.
Like several different
punched him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Really nasty looking.
Did you think he got like a bite mark, maybe?
Yeah, or fingers. It was kind of hard to tell, but it could well have been. I think someone says you just ran into something in the sleep. It could have been like a tree, you know, branches. It just walked into. It could have been that, right?
Yeah, I guess if the branches were kind of low, maybe
broken. Yeah.
That could have done that, but I feel like when he was saying that, he was just sort of trying to find an excuse because he didn't want to admit like something was going on that was terribly abnormal, you know.
Did like the way they synthesized the shop in the woods. I think that worked well, actually. It had almost, I know, dreamlike isn't the right word. It almost felt like it's the sort of things they do in, I don't know, comic books and stuff like that, when they sort of integrate in two disparate scenes. They did it well.
They did. And Becky, you mentioned that the shop was not in the book, right? So did he have any specific dream in the book that you can recall?
I can't recall specifics. I read it so long ago. I'm going to have to read it again now, though. Definitely, I'll just talk about it. But I will say that I think the shop and the way that the lighting is so harsh was really effective for me against the darkness of the woods, because of his guilt, especially. He can't get away from it. That, you know, really strobey, harsh lighting.
I agree. I think the lighting was definitely used very effectively, as you said, in the dream, but also in the woods. I don't really know how you film outside and get sort of things to look right, you know, because I think we've all taken our cell phones at some point and, you know, you can film outside, but getting things to kind of look creepy like they did in this film, that takes a really good cinematographer.
It does. I mean, the camera tech also helps.
Because
new cameras pick up like way better than some of the older ones. You know, in the wrong hands, it could have been ridiculous looking, but they kind of integrated the woods and the shop really well. I've really got no complaints at all about this film to this point. I think it's very solid and it improves with rewatch.
The other guys, they also have horrible nightmares. We have Hutch. When he wakes up, he's actually peed all over himself. And I mean, I was like, oh, wow, you don't see that from grown men, you know. And Dom is shouting for his wife. And most terrifying of all to me was that Phil is upstairs. And I believe it's Luke who sees his clothes like strolling all about. He goes upstairs and Phil is upstairs naked praying to this effigy. And that was pretty terrifying, I thought. That one really worked.
Yeah, it was such a weird position. It wasn't like hands together praying. He was like holding one fist out and the other hand was wrapped around his wrist. It was a really weird and disconcerting sort of visual. And then he slowly kind of recovers, doesn't he? Realizes where he's at and stuff.
Yeah, and I think he doesn't really want to admit what's happened at that point, you know?
I thought it was really interesting how that character, Phil, was the first person to see the effigy because he was the first person to go upstairs.
Yeah, I was wondering that too, if there was a connection. Like, he was the first one most powerfully struck by it.
In terms of his character and the lack of development, it would have been interesting to tie what happened there into his background personally, because I know that with Dom, for example, he's calling out his wife's name during his nightmare. And that does tie into eventually what happens to him a little bit.
Yeah, it does. If I was doing this film again, I'd either beef up Phil's role or would have cut Phil as a character and made it Hutchin doing the praying. You know, everyone would have had full character development. It was just a slight lack, I think, with that. But it was kind of interesting, you know, the way they used him. For visual purposes, that was kind of startling.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he never really recovers, does he?
No. And the thing is, for us to know someone has been badly changed by something like that, he's got to have had a much fuller personality development earlier. So, you know, we don't know. He might be acting the same before it, after it, as before it, because we didn't see that much of him.
Yeah, I think sometimes less is more, and maybe one less character here would have worked.
Yeah, it did suffer a bit from two. There was a character there that could have been filled in by one of the others, I think.
Yeah.
But never mind. You know, this is nitpicking, I have
to
say.
It is. It really is nitpicking. So the guys head out to get the hell away from this cabin, and who can blame them at this point? They find carvings on trees. And again, you know, I'm thinking Blair Witch Project here. And but what can you do at this point? I mean, it's too far to go back, so the only thing you can really do is move forward. There's a path leading away from the cabin, and Dom and Phil want to take it. Hutch and Luke want to go in the direction they should be heading, but they literally stray away from their original path. Probably not a good idea. Eventually, they're lost, tempers flare, and Dom says what everyone has been thinking, and that is that Luke could have saved Bob. even Hutch reluctantly says that he doesn't know what to think and has to defuse the situation when Luke punches Dom in the face. And you know, you can't really blame him considering what Dom was saying to him.
Yeah, I mean, they're all a bit ragged here. And I like the way that they didn't overdo this. You know, you could kind of tell everyone was kind of thinking it. And you could kind of tell just from the acting that Luke was kind of suspected that's how they felt. It was very well done. Can I just go back to the bit where they come out of the cabin and there's weird symbols on the trees?
Absolutely.
I did actually look that up, and I don't know if this was intentional or if they just picked a symbol, but I did find out what that symbol meant in Runic. And it means a few different things, but one of the things it means is property, i.e. this is my property, perhaps. So there is that. And if it was inverted, it would mean slavery.
Oh, wow. That's even more frightening.
So, yeah. I thought it was worth checking. Because it was just one type of rune that I saw. It was like a fish on its tail kind of shape, right? Squared off.
Yeah, I just thought, I had no clue it was authentic, to be honest with you. I just thought, oh, that is pretty cool looking.
Yeah, so it all kicks off, doesn't it? And the accusations fly, and there's a bit of violence, but they kind of start to come apart. Again, this is reflecting kind of what happened in this Descent. That was like a small group under pressure get frazzed. And this is a common trope in zombie films too, right? That zombies don't get you. It's the other humans you'll start with.
They always get mad at each other at some point.
So it was definitely a touch of that, right?
Yeah, dissension in the ranks, so to speak.
Mm.
I think that's the case with survivalist horror, though. That's what it always pairs down to, those tensions and the dynamics of the relationships. But for me, it was quite powerful and quite satisfying when Luke did punch Dom in the face. And in the book, Dom's been going on and on and on. So it's the same thing happens, but, you know, it's not obviously about another friend's death. And as powerful as that was when Luke said, you know, you're no longer my friend, you know, that's it, now we're done, it was more, I think, impactful for me the way that Hutch, when Luke turned to him and said, do you think this? Do you think that, you know, this was my fault? And he says, I don't know what to think. So he's been trying to be in his corner, and they had a little moment right at the beginning of the holiday where they were stood together away from the other two, and Hutch was saying, you know, we know it's not your fault, don't worry about it, trying to clear the air. But for him to say that at this point, I think that's what hurts more. And that was, it just kind of breaks up the group.
Yeah, it was done really well. Firstly, it's great dialogue. But secondly, the actual, you know, the words could have been done in a lot of different ways. And he did it in a kind of a sympathetic way. It's like more like resigned, you know, I don't know what to think.
Yeah.
You know, i.e. we might be in this situation, there's all this hell going on, I'm not even thinking about it. You know, it could be like that, or it could be, you know, I don't know, I think maybe there's something in it, it could be another thing. Yeah. But the thing is, the words are ambiguous enough that there's all these interpretations, and it was acted really well. You know, excellent. One thing I will say about this scene, it made me think of, and this whole small group of men stuck somewhere they don't want to be and starting to unravel, made me think of, as a film that's not that well known, Walter Hill film called Southern Comfort, about a group of sort of men doing like military exercises in the Louisiana, I think, backwards, and kind of getting lost and then crossing the locals, and they're, it has a kind of similar vibe. It's a much tougher, manly man kind of film, but it's got a very similar vibe. And if you haven't seen it, I'd recommend it. And this scene in particular reminded me of a similar scene in that film.
Yeah, and doesn't Hutch have some kind of military background as well?
He seems pretty... Hutch is interesting because at the beginning, it's almost like when he's putting out with Dom shit, it's kind of like, I'm just trying to keep a lid on this. But you feel like he's one of these guys that pretends to be in control, but actually wants to project anger. So it's kind of passive aggressive. But as it goes on, he's a much more complex character to me than that. I'm not quite sure I'm explaining myself. You know, there's certain people that say, yes, do this, and everything will be fine. But you just know there's this simmering rage, or they're pretending there's this simmering rage, which is a bit more sophisticated, just to get you to do stuff. And I had a feeling from that from Hutch, but he became more sympathetic to me, actually. I think he was, at one point they were talking about Dom, and he says, and he keeps saying to him, you can walk for it, mate, like he's not sympathetic. But then he says later on, someone else, he says, he's not going to get anywhere with that knee. So he knows it's bad. So he's just been doing it to sort of G him up, to keep him moving. But it's not because he's unsympathetic. It's just he knows they need to get out of there, right?
Yeah, definitely. And he seems to have more training, like whatever background, because he mentioned something about going somewhere after the holiday or staying on.
Yeah, he wants to stay a bit longer. It's like he likes hiking. At least that, but he could be military. He's the type. He feels like the type. He's kind of looks after himself. He's obviously in good shape.
Yeah, he's kind of like the manly man of the group, right?
Yeah, he's the sort of guy who goes climb mountains and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic to hear such a Manc accent as well. I did laugh at that.
Oh, yeah, Manc. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah.
He's proper Manc. I think the actor's from Stockport. Okay. And he's been in like Coronation Street and such, but just the way he's, proper, like Shameless, the television series, reminded me of.
Very strong, yeah, Lucard, very strong Mancunian accent that was. Or not that strong, but distinctive, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
There's stronger accents than that, Manc accents than that.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that was pretty strong. I was like, let's go down this pathway, not that way, proper like Liam Gallagher kind of.
He did look a bit like Liam Gallagher as well. Like, spotted.
See, I'm learning accents. UNH can be used as a teaching tool. They set up camp and something takes Hutch. The next day, they do find his body, but it's far too late by that point. And I think we all knew he was dead anyway. So he's been splayed up in the trees, which is similar to the animal carcass that we saw in the beginning. Becky, what did you think of this scene?
Well, I was really upset that it was actually Hutch, because, like you say, he's quite an interesting, complex character, very sympathetic in the end, I think. And it was a shame to lose him in such a horrible way to go. And we don't know the ins and outs of what's happened at this point. So for them all to see that, I think particularly for Phil, that just breaks him from that point then. Whatever had happened before and whatever he saw, we don't know what he dreamt, that he doesn't recover at all from this point.
No. Yeah, I mean, nice foreshadowing of the animal before, so we kind of knew something did that. Now, obviously, it's not this, that wasn't an accident. He was deliberately put there by something, and it must have been something powerful to lift a man up that high and do that to him. So it's pretty terrifying.
And at this point, they have no food and they're being hunted. But, I mean, they have to continue on, because at this point, they're also pretty much lost, I believe. Luke sees glimpses of whatever is following them. And I think this is so effective, because you're not actually really seeing what is hunting them. You kind of get these glimpses. And even at points, I found myself like thinking that I saw something, but I was like, oh no, it's actually, there's actually nothing there. So I thought that was, again, very effective. Sometimes it's what you don't see, as you guys mentioned earlier.
Yeah, this was a lovely scene. I mean, the whole bank of trees he was in, and then there was a shot lifting outwards and upwards from the top, above the trees. I think it was this bit anyway. And then him looking through the trees, it was very spooky. And, it was quite a still forest. The rain had stopped, so there was that. And, him not being able to see for sure, there was something there, but there was definitely something moving. But you couldn't get a shape on it or anything like that. Whether it was a man. But he realized it was big, right? He does say that it was big.
They do mention that, yeah. And Phil, we already talked how he was pretty much broken. He is also taken by the unseen monster. Did you guys at this point, did you think it might be like a werewolf, or did you have any specific kind of creature in mind at this point?
I thought it was a physical thing. I thought it was something akin to maybe a Bigfoot or a demon of some sort.
Yeah, and having read the book, the way that this... Are we giving major spoilers here?
Well, we're doing spoilers anyway.
We've thrown up the warnings.
Having read the book already, the creature is described in such a way that it's terrifying. And when you actually see the creature, monster, whatever you want to call it, in the film, I was surprised, actually, at how it's been depicted. And for me, I was imagining all sorts still because of the way I can't quite describe how effective the book is. The atmosphere in the book is claustrophobic. And I'll say this for all of Neville's writing. Have either of you read any of his books?
No,
I haven't either.
I would absolutely recommend them. They are so, like I say, effective and atmospheric that I have to put them down at certain points because they really affect you on, I think, a psychological level. There's very few books. I'd say Thomas Ligotti's books are very similar.
I'm definitely going to have to add this to my reading list, which is, it's quite long now, actually, because of horror films. You know, and there are all these great films that are oftentimes start out as books, and so I'm like, oh, I want to read that, and, you know, the list continues to grow.
I've only got time for Stephen King.
Kingology.
Yes.
If there was any new author that I would recommend somebody, it would be Adam Neville. His books are that good. And I've heard a lot of people say exactly the same thing as me. So it's not necessarily, I mean, obviously it's subjective, but a lot of people seem to agree with just how atmospheric they are. And the way, like I say, the monster's described and the bits the characters see in the book, it could have gone all different manner of ways, I think, the way that it was depicted in the film. So I thought it was a really interesting choice with the design there.
Well, we return to the opening scene, and at this point, Luke is hallucinating while awake. Becky, you said that you've heard some criticism of the opening scene being returned by this hallucination, particularly by the amount of times that the material is used. Honestly, as I was watching it, I didn't think anything about it. I actually thought it was very suiting to kind of return to that store that haunts him.
I thought that it wasn't repeated too many times at all. I thought that it, like you say, it worked well with the narrative to develop everything that was going on. Maybe for somebody, and this is where I have to kind of try and change my mindset, because for somebody coming to this film new without having read the original material, I think you would have a completely different experience to having read the book and how you approach it. So I think maybe people just wanted to get to the whole what is going on and more of the supernatural or folkloric elements necessarily than the PTSD. But I didn't think in terms of narrative or time that, and especially with character development, that was an issue. I mean, we saw slight changes every time that it went back to reflect what was happening in a way. I mean, Matt, you've watched this twice out of us all. You've seen the film twice now. How did you feel?
The first time I thought it was overdone. I thought, oh, I'm not this again. Probably this point, right? But on the second watch, it felt quite right and natural, which I think is probably the key thing to make me feel it was. I enjoyed it better the second time because this repeating, you know, his revisiting of the seed of this trauma felt right. It does with PTSD. It's you kind of, I've been in some, I don't want to really get into it, but I've been in sort of road accidents and suffered a bit from PTSD from that. And you kind of play it in your head if you're ever in a situation similar to that one where it happens, as a way of almost exercising it by saying, well, this could happen, but it didn't this time. So it's almost like trying to desensitize yourself. Your own mind tries to desensitize yourself. So I kind of get it. And the second time, it was a better watch.
So now we come to the part of the film where we sort of get the reveal, not completely. Luke and Dom are captured by hill people. It's funny because I instantly thought, like, hillbillies, you know, being an American. And but, you know, these are kind of the, I guess, Swedish hill people. And so we've talked about, you know, folk horror quite a bit. And this is definitely folk horror. There's quite a change in the film's tone from here. You know, it goes from kind of a survival film to more of a folk horror film. These people are interesting. They're living a secular lifestyle, and they appear to have just a very long lifespan because they worship this creature. What did you guys think, first of all, of the hill people? What were your initial reactions? And also, what did you think of sort of the tonal shift?
Yeah, this is where the film got worse. It dropped down a level for me. I would really dug the first, I think the first hour. I think this happens in the last half hour, even the last 20 minutes. And it kind of stepped down the gear. But, you know, Stephen King's gone through this. You can keep terror up for so long, but at some point you have to open the door and show what the thing is. And often it doesn't work, but it would be a cheat not to open the door. And writers and filmmakers that try to get away with not opening the door are often, you know, despised because they're cheating the audience of what they want. And so you have to open the door. And I felt that this time for this film, it didn't quite live up to the first two thirds. However, it was reasonably satisfying. I was still reasonably happy with how it all turned out. It just felt like once they got to that village or that place, you know, that they kind of, it was almost like they were called there of their own accord, right? Because there seemed to be only one route out of the forest, and they decided to take it, which led them to this place, which is kind of an interesting, almost like fairy tale quality to this part. But when they get there, the fairy tale quality dispenses with entirely, and it becomes, you know, as you say, Swedish hillbillies kind of thing, right? It was decent, but it didn't live up to the first two thirds for me.
In terms of the third section, I've heard a lot of people say that they felt that it was weaker than the first two, but I think that the tonal shift could have worked if the emphasis on the people themselves and their way of life, you know, we had a bit more time on that, because it's a very brief introduction to them. And while I think that the mystery helps in one sense, I think because of the tonal shift, it needed something more. And it's the same in the book. The book changes very abruptly as well. But it's actually just a couple of characters, not a whole group of people, and slight differences in terms of it's not a group of people that have long life in the kind of cult sense. It's two people that are into black metal and basically paganism. So I would have liked more, especially because of the symbol. We find out that all of these people have the same symbol that Luke was branded with. And because he's given the choice to stay with them, I'm guessing because of the symbol itself, then what does that mean? Nothing. If that was explained a little bit, I think mystery is very effective in this sense, and you just need to get that balance right, and we needed a bit more information in certain parts.
Well, I like the fact that he was separated from the rest because of, you know, the traumatic event, in effect, right? He'd suffered, so the creature kind of recognized something in him that meant he would be part of this community. He could function as part of this community. I kind of like that idea.
Yeah, maybe, like I say, from reading the book, you know, I just expected a little bit more. But yeah, you've got to see them as two, you know, very different things, I think. You know, that they're different and they have their own merits. I think, you know, there's certain choices in the film, there's certain things in the book that I think the two of them together make a really interesting pairing in terms of the different choices. And I'd be really interested to hear what you both think, if, you know, having read the book and then seen the film.
Yeah,
I think this might have worked for me a bit more, you know, if the people did not seem like it was a happy life, right? They seemed depressed or something.
Yeah, they didn't seem too happy.
If they'd have been a bit more zealots, you know, and you know, a bit more fanatical about worshipping the thing, it might have worked a little better for me. But you know, this is what the film we've got, so it's fine. that may have been worse though, so I'm not entirely sure. There was just something, it didn't feel quite right. Like, why are these people doing this? They want to live a longer life, but in a miserable way. You know, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
so much.
Yeah, I agree. Dom is sacrificed by the people, and you know, he thinks he's seeing his wife before being impaled by the creature on a tree, of course, you know, kind of the same way. You know, I got to ask, first of all, what did you guys think of the creature? And second of all, were you glad that Dom kind of got his?
Shall I take this, Becky?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I thought the creature design was fine. It was like a big deer with human arms hanging from its head. And I thought that was fine. And I like this whole ritualistic thing of pressing the victims into the tree as a sacrifice. And the hill people actually mention they don't take the bodies down, right? And stuff like that. Yeah, and I'm glad Dom got his, actually. Yeah, he was annoying me. I did think it was really interesting that he saw his wife. So that suggests this thing operates in the mind as well as being a physical presence.
Yeah, I think there's reference to the creature having some kind of shape-shifting ability. But I think the point that Matt made there about the psychological effect of the creature is really interesting when you connect that to the whole, you know, the PTSD themes of the film. But the way that it actually hangs its victims on the trees, I think, is a reference to Odin, who was meant to have gained wisdom. Yeah. By particularly, I think, a rune magic, as Matt mentioned about the runes initially on the trees outside of the cabin. I think that Odin was meant to, you know, hang himself from the world tree and impale himself on his spear. So
it's a big thing, isn't it? The God on a tree, Jesus on the cross, Odin on the tree, Conan on the tree. You know, it's kind of a symbol of gaining something or transitioning. So yeah.
I think so. And the creature is kind of ent-like in a way.
Yeah, it's got tree qualities.
The concept design was actually by the artist who worked with Guillermo del Toro on several of his films that he produced and directed. So I think you can see those influences there.
Yeah. Why it moved in some of the scenes remind me a bit of, you know, when Star Wars or other fantasy films get the guys that do the Muppets to do bigger monsters. It kind of moved a bit like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's not really how I imagined it at all, though. And I don't think it's as scary at all as the book. But again,
it feels more like a beast. It feels more like a beast.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Isn't it? I wouldn't call it scary either.
No.
So at this point, Luke is trying to escape, and he sets fire to the decrepit bodies that are in the top floor of the cabin he's held in. And these bodies are set out like they are in a chapel in front of another effigy.
Yeah, these are like posed, right? Almost a bit Texas Chainsaw Massacre-y.
Ooh, that's a good comparison, yeah.
Exactly, like Grandpa.
They're not dead. That's the thing, they're not dead.
So this long life, touching on, again, what Mark said there, that you are literally, you know, you're alive till you rot and crumble. So why would people want that?
It would be an interesting backstory kind of to see how, like, why these people accepted that kind of life and if they knew they were going to be alive to that point of crumbling, you know.
It's almost like this demon. I mean, they describe it as the spawn of Loki, right?
Yes.
It's almost like this demon that brings these people in to continue suffering a hell. You know, they're suffering for some reason. You know, he had guilt, but he was kind of responsible, right? It wasn't like he accidentally, his friend died and he witnessed it. He was kind of could have interceded. So is this kind of, is he bringing him, anyone here who's suffering through something they did themselves, so therefore it's a kind of hell? I wondered, you know, is that kind of, that's what I was, it's kind of a bit more ambiguous than that, but it isn't a happy place. It's not like come and worship, you know, the beast and you can live a long life. It's like, oh, we're here, you're here,
yeah,
do you want to come do this with us? It's a bit like that.
That's a really good point, that it's atonement. Like you say, it is their own personal hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, not a fun place to be at all.
In fact, the whole thing could be seen as an allegory of guilt, right?
Yeah, do you completely.
Live with it or do you escape from it, right?
So that's the sequel, right? Luke finds a weapon in a storage room and he has to kind of kill some of the villagers or the hill people, if you will. I couldn't help but think of Nicolas Cage as he's kind of running around here. Did you guys get any Nick Cage vibe or was that just me?
When he started screaming at the monster at the end, yeah, a bit. But I did like the bit, the thing that should have worked, that did though, was the whole bit where he's in the forest, he's done on which way to go, and suddenly we see the strobe lights, not strobe lights, fluorescent tubes lighting a tunnel into the away from the forest. And at that point, I can ask you guys this. Did you think it was his way out, or did you think it was a trap leading him into something?
His way out, I think, because he's like you say, he's got to make that choice and he's got to accept what happened and move on. Definitely. But just to come back to Nicolas Cage, didn't he punch a woman in this?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, man. Yep.
Cage move.
Yep.
Yep.
The ultimate feminist move, that is. I'm going to get into trouble for saying that. But Lucard, what do you think? Was it a way out? What did you see it as his way out or his descent into worse?
Yeah, I kind of thought it was his way out. I sort of read it as straightforward, I guess, you know.
Just me then. I thought that's a trap. I thought,
did you?
It's a trap. And it wasn't, was it, right? But it struck me quite distinctly. That creature's leading him into something. But
it would have been interesting.
I was wrong. Right?
Well, it would have been interesting if, it would have been that.
He manages to sort of overcome this, I don't know, big elk demon thing, right?
Yeah.
What was Loki doing that produced that? That's what I'm
I know. My goodness. Who did he have sex with?
What is this? I'm seeing Tom Hiddleston now. This is bad.
So ultimately, Luke is the sole survivor of this film. Honestly, I did not expect him to survive.
Do you think there was going to be a bait and switch of him getting caught again or something right there?
Yeah, something like that.
Because we're used to that. That's what it is.
But yeah, you know, I thought the monster, we've discussed it a little bit already, the fact that he was a child of Loki.
So in terms of the design, it's a mixture of human and animal elements, as we've seen. And I thought the hands were really interesting because of the whole guilt thing and action. And I don't know, maybe that's reading too much into it, but the creature is actually referred to, I believe, as a Jotun. And the plural term for this is Jotnar, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which means devourers. And they are said to be primordial entities, and they're described in various different ways, but often as trolls or giants.
Cool. It made me think of Grendel a bit, some of this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so. And like we've touched upon it, this particular creature is meant to be a child of the Norse god Loki. And there are various different types of Jotun, so mountain giants or forest giants, I believe. So it suggests that they have different domains, which ties into the end of the film in that Luke literally stumbles over the border to the edge of the forest, and the creature can't cross that border. So that very primal sense of power over a particular area I thought was interesting.
Yeah, you know, that bit reminded me of The Village. You know, The Village, where they're in this sort of 19th century village, and as long as they don't stay at the point where the woods start, don't go beyond that point, they're safe. But if they go into the woods, they're not. So it definitely made me think of that too. Though The Witch is like, you're not safe anywhere, but the woods are the worst place to be in that film.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And even within the rules and regulations of that particular area where that power is, they offer gifts. And I think one of the words they use, I was just doing a bit of research into the film, one of the words that the villagers, if that's the right term, use is like offerings of food to the god itself. So a demigod, whatever you want to call it. So it's really tying into, like I say, rules and regulations. And if you give so much that, you know, no harm will come to you. But it just at the end, the woman that goes in and actually speaks to Luke and shows him her marking and tells him, you know, you need to stay here and you'll be all right. You'll have long life. You'll be looked after. Just make sure you worship this creature. Whether it's because she's doubting, because she seems a bit troubled, I don't know. But the creature goes for her and takes her, even though they're doing everything that they should be doing. They've given it a human sacrifice. So it's interesting how those rules and regulations, especially in terms of the ending and Luke, who is forced to the ground by the hands of the creature. It doesn't impale him. It throws him to the ground and tries to make him bow, it seems.
Yeah, it's almost like you. This is how you do it, right? It's a bit of that.
So it suggests that it wanted him in that fold and that he has to make that decision himself. So coming back to your point, Mark, I think it does suggest, it's quite a strong suggestion that that's the reading one should take from it, that this is about guilt.
Indeed. It kind of tied to something, you know, I keep adding new layers to all this. It tied a bit to me to, you know, it, how Pennywise survives on fear, feeds on fear. It's almost like this creature survives on guilt.
Yeah.
There is that possibility, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Maybe that's why all the villagers are there. They find guilt over something.
Yeah, and obviously it would benefit such a creature to elongate their lives, right? It's more food.
Absolutely.
Got to keep the cows healthy, keep milking them, right? It's that kind of thing.
And I know that the director spoke about his appreciation of films that withhold the reveal of the monster until the very, very end, but that he felt that this story required the monster to be seen slightly sooner than that. And it is still, you know, near enough to
the end. Yeah. I mean, it's the last act for sure. And not even start of the last act. It's in the middle of the last act.
Yeah, I mean, we do get the partial reveals throughout the film in different... I mean, we see hands at some point, human hands. So we already know that it can shapeshift or that it has that ability to, you know, get into the psyche. So we can see how people would see different things. But coming back to what Luca said earlier, for me personally, every single shot feels threatening when they're in the woods. Mm. Every shadow and tree could be a glimpse of what it is. You're actively looking to see glimpses of it yourself. And that kind of pareidolia, I think, makes the film quite interactive and just really ramps up the atmosphere. Even though you are seeing, technically, in some instances, actual glimpses of the creature, most of the time in horror, as we know, the sooner you see something, the, you know, the fear factor just crumbles away. And that's a big pet peeve, as I've said before, with certain films like, you know, The Woman in Black. I really enjoy the film, but I think that the reveal was just way too early.
Mm. Yeah. No, this was done really well. I have to agree with you there, Becky. This structuring was really well. In some ways, it reminded me of Alien, you know? We see little glimpses or we just get these long sort of takes of nothing happening, but you're never sure if something's just about to happen or not. It's got that kind of feel. But this is a little more tense in places, in that you, when certainly when someone glimpsing through trees trying to see something is inherently tense, right?
Yeah.
And it's done quite well.
Yeah. And the ending, I loved him screaming back at the creature as it's roaring. And
Cagey.
Having punched a woman and screaming, but,
and again, if that creature existed on Gil, it may be repelled by other emotions. So if that was anger, that might actually be doing something.
Exactly. And it's just a great ending, I think, that he's come through this journey and been forced to, through this, you know, survivalist experience, confront all of those feelings. And there's a distinct moral to the story, which I think is, do not be friends with this man, because if you do, you will die.
And with that, we come to ratings.
I really like this film. The first time I watched it, I rated it 7 out of 10. And I honestly felt that my rating wouldn't change after that. I felt like I'd sort of rung everything. It wasn't a film I felt like I needed to rewatch, actually. Because I felt I got a full satisfying experience the first time, and I didn't feel it had any more depth than I'd already got. And there was plenty of depth. I'm not saying it's shallow. That's not what I meant at all. But I just felt that the first time was enough to get everything you really needed to about the film. But I rewatched it anyway. And I actually enjoyed it a lot more, mainly because the repeating activity of, you know, him revisiting the scene of the shop, the scene of the PTSD, actually worked better for me the second time. The first time I felt it was a bit overdone, but the second time it felt much more natural. So it did work better for me, and it wasn't any less enjoyable for that. So I'm going to rate it with my second score from the second viewing, which is 8 out of 10.
I would have to also give this an 8 out of 10. I think it's a fantastic adaptation that changes things from the source material, but in, I think, the right way. I think it blends survival horror with folklore, folk horror itself as a subgenre. And yes, the tone does change. And I think there are some problems with that in that we don't necessarily get as much time as we'd need with certain characters, certain narrative shifts, shall we say. But I think that it blends everything together really well. It's atmospheric, it's scary, not necessarily the monster, but the scenes building up to the reveal, and the whole PTSD element really works well with the supernatural aspects of it. And I think it's one of those films you could argue, again, is it psychological potentially? So for me, yeah, it would have to be an 8. And I would say if anybody hasn't read the book, or like I say, any of Adam Neville's books, they're really, really great. The best new horror for me.
You guys know the only thing that would make this film better? Nick Cage.
Nick Cage remake.
Exactly. So next year, the American version is going to come, and it's going to be Nicolas Cage in this role. Seriously, I agree with everything you both said, and I'm also going to give it a solid 8 out of 10, a very well-made film. And with that, we are going to hit a quick break, but we're coming right back with your feedback right here on the United Nations of Horror.
Okay, so here we are. I'm driving this section. We're doing feedback. We've got some feedback from some of our fellow UNHers about this movie. First thing is Andrew Rooney. He says, this does what most horror films can't do. It has us intrigued and honestly scared. My wife had nightmares last night.
Oh,
I'm saying that a bit too gleeful. Oh, that's no good.
Yeah, hopefully it's not gleeful, right?
And finally, some relatable characters, real people with a real and meaningful backstory. I agree. Good point. I don't care about entitled 28-year-old American teens with perfect teeth. Me neither.
Amen.
Here's a gripe, though. The heroin shop scene. Great plot device, well handled and relevant. This scene would often get handled really clumsily in a horror film, but why keep going into that world? The first one was trippy and unexpected, but I get it. No need to go back every 10 minutes. I kind of had the same gripe the first watch, but not the second watch. We've kind of talked about that bit already, haven't we, in terms of the repeating thing. And Erin Miskell replying to Andrew says, see, I like this a lot because it just... because it got how much a flashback to trauma can suck you in and disrupt reality. Yeah.
Good point. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
That's why I think it didn't bother me the second time. It kind of felt like it made more sense. Michael Harvey then commented, extremely well-made horror flick and a refreshing change from the usual dumb teens in peril. Right.
We need OAPs, it seems, in horror. Did you get a call for it? OAPs in horror?
OAPs in horror. Old people. Yeah, a few old people, horror. That's what we need. Cockney versus zombies, right? If that's what you want, I'm telling you.
I was going to say the same thing.
Then Eric Anderson said, I really liked it, especially upon reflection. I was happy that I didn't see any trailers, so I had no idea where the film was headed. The characters are relatable and the acting was solid. I recommend snuggling in and giving it a watch. Yeah, good point. And we have to stress, this is on Netflix US. So if you live in the US and you've got Netflix, why wouldn't you watch this?
Oh, yeah.
Get on with it.
Given. Definitely go out and see it. I only saw the Netflix trailer. I didn't see the, I guess, original trailer. And I didn't think it gave too much away. But I will say the trailer did a good job of making me like really intrigued to see this. In fact, I actually had this in my queue even before we decided we were going to be.
Did it properly represent the film? Because so many trailers don't. Do you feel that what you got, what you expected from the? Did the trailer not mislead you?
It didn't mislead me. You know, I guess I thought it was going to be more of a almost like maybe a Blair Witch kind of vibe to it, but I think it had that a little bit, but I enjoyed this far more than Blair Witch. Anyone who's listened to our whole podcast already knows how I feel about that film. So, yeah, I thought it was good.
PTSD.
You're just saying random words now.
I'm saying for Luke had to think about Blair Witch.
Oh, I see. PTSD. Yeah, PTSD. I'm like that with Highlander 2. I've suffered from PTSD from Highlander 2. Okay. Dan Stout says, watch it tonight and I really enjoyed it. All kinds of little details done perfectly. What impressed me the most was the attention to detail in things like the sound design. Absolutely. We didn't really talk about the sound design, did we? It was very subtle, wasn't it? I thought.
I think, because it is so subtle and it sounds so, you know, natural and you're just completely in that world, you don't tend to think about it.
Indeed. Some of the best soundtracks, sound designs are subtle like that. And some of them are like crazy not subtle at all. You know, David Lynch's sound design is not subtle, but it's still very effective. But anyway, getting off topic. Dan went on to say this film actually gets the sound of the woods right, from the touch of the echo on snapping branches to the way that a tent zipper at night can sound like the loudest thing in the world. The filmmakers create an immersive experience grounded in reality, and this in turn made the rising paranoia and appearance of the supernatural all the more disturbing. Very well put, Dan.
You can tell he's a writer, can't you?
And then one last comment from Craig Pay. Enjoyed it a great deal and thought the threat once revealed was fantastic. So he did like the ending. So there we go. Some good feedback there. Thank you very much, everyone who sent in feedback. So we're going to close off now. I know Luca was sharing, but I'm going to close the show, right? So thanks for joining me, Luca and Becky. And thanks for everyone for listening. So bye from me.
Bye from me.
And bye from me.
And until next time on United Nations of Horror. As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any thoughts on this week's topic or anything else horror related, email your messages in MP3 format to unitednationsofhorror@gmail.com or drop us a line at this address. Also, you can call in for free and leave us a voicemail with your comments on 404-480-2545. Let the number ring a few times and you'll be taken to the voicemail. Please be sure to leave your name and where you're calling from. Or head over to our website for all the latest podcast information, articles and reviews at unitednationsofhorror.com. Also, be sure to join our Facebook group, which is www.facebook.com/groups/UN of Horror. You can also find us on Twitter, and we are at UNH Podcast, all as one word. Thanks to my co-host for joining me today. Until next time, you've been listening to the United Nations of Horror.